From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Joss Whedon. He's the executive producer of Buffy and co-executive producer of the Buffy spin-off Angel. In both shows, Whedon has created a fantasy world which rings truer than most shows on TV. Before Buffy, Whedon wrote for the series Roseanne, and he's written some screenplays. He's worked on the scripts for Toy Story, Speed, and this summer's The X-Men. And linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about the problems with censorware, the software programs made to block access to so-called objectionable content on the internet. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Former four-term Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards has been convicted on 17 counts of racketeering and fraud in a riverboat casino licensing scheme. Jim Engster reports from Baton Rouge.
The 72-year-old Edwards, who twice before eluded federal prosecutors in high-profile trials, faces the prospect of living the rest of his life in prison. The Cajun populace took the guilty verdict with his customary humor, though.
The Chinese have a saying that if you sit by the river long enough, the dead body of your enemy will come floating down the river. I suppose the feds sat by the river long enough, so here comes my body.
Edwards' son, Stephen, was also found guilty of racketeering. Three co-defendants were convicted on various charges. State Senator Greg Tarver of Shreveport was acquitted, as was another defendant. Defense attorneys promised an appeal after a juror portrayed as pro-defense was dismissed from deliberations last week. For NPR News, I'm Jim Engster in Baton Rouge.
Key U.S. lawmakers today said they had agreed to legislation to set up a commission to monitor Chinese human rights. The deal improves prospects for passage of President Clinton's landmark trade accord with Beijing. The White House sees the legislation as a way of reaching out to Democrats in the House who want to air their concerns about human rights and labor abuses in China in exchange for supporting the market opening pact. Amnesty International is urging the United States United Nations watchdog group to condemn the United States for what it calls institutionalized forms of torture, especially within the justice system. A report from Amnesty International alleges abusive practices in the U.S. on the eve of the U.S. government's first appearance before the U.N. Committee Against Torture. From Geneva, Lisa Schlein reports.
Amnesty International says America's increasingly punitive approach toward offenders is leading to practices which facilitate torture and other inhuman practices. It notes the spiraling prison population is contributing to widespread ill-treatment of men, women, and children in custody. Amnesty accuses the police of brutality, especially against racial and ethnic minorities. Abuses include the use of long-term isolation in super-maximum security units, the routine use of chemical sprays to subdue suspects and prisoners, and the use of stun guns in local jails and courts. Amnesty demands an end to police beatings and the shooting of unarmed suspects. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
George W. Bush has John McCain's endorsement, though McCain said today's announcement was like swallowing a mouthful of medicine. Still, McCain says he's looking forward to campaigning for Bush, and he says he does not want the number two spot on the ticket. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 67 points to close at 10,536. Volume was 895 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite was down 85 to close at 35,84. This is NPR News. Fighting has spread in Sierra Leone today, and UN peacekeepers lost ground. The U.S. argues that West Africa needs to get more involved in restoring order, but leaders from the region met in Abuja, Nigeria today and agreed only that their defense ministers will take up the crisis next week. Gilbert DaCosta is in Abuja.
There's a sense of fatigue within West Africa with regard to the situation in Sierra Leone. When Nigeria and other countries in the sub-region got deeply involved militarily in Sierra Leone, there was very little support from the world community. And now the United Nations has gotten involved and things seem to have gone out of control. Well, Nigeria seemed not to be in a hurry to deploy troops because it wants to secure the best possible terms from the world community in terms of financial support and the provision of logistical support.
The UN has requested Nigeria contribute 2 battalions to a rapid reaction force that could bolster last year's peace agreement. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson said today he plans to meet privately with his counterparts from oil-producing countries Indonesia, Mexico, and Venezuela this week. The meeting would come a month ahead of the scheduled OPEC gathering to decide whether or not to increase world oil supply. Richardson said the United States is pleased with the recent stabilization in oil prices. The jackpot for tonight's big game lottery has reached $350 million. Up to now, the U.S. record stood at $295.7 million. People have been standing in line to buy tickets in the 7 states where the game is played. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 67 points today to close at 10,536. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross.
You really have no idea what's going on, do you? You think it's coincidence you're being here? That boy was just the beginning.
Oh, why can't you people just leave me alone?
Because you are the Slayer. Into each generation, a Slayer is born. One girl in all the world, a chosen one, one born with the
strength and skill to hunt the vampires, to stop the spread of their evil blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
I really don't understand this attitude. You've accepted your duty. You've slain vampires before.
Yeah, and I've both been there and done that, and I'm moving on.
That's Sarah Michelle Gellar and Anthony Stewart Head from the very first episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a 20th Century Fox production that airs on the WB. The show and the character were created by my guest, Joss Whedon. Viewers put off by the silly Buffy the Vampire Slayer title, or by monster dramas in general, are missing something really special here. Despite its paranormal situations and characters, and sometimes because of them, Buffy is turning out some of the best stuff on TV right now. Genuinely funny jokes and seriously dramatic situations are doled out in equal measure. The show is full of metaphors about how loved ones can turn into monsters, how high school and college life is a particular type of hell, and how everyone, to some extent, is haunted by his or her own demons. Characters grow, change, and sometimes even die. And Buffy, through the course of the series so far, has survived high school, left home and her first serious relationship behind, and moved on to college while still fighting demons on the side. She's gotten older and wiser, but life hasn't gotten any easier. This season, Buffy generated its first spin-off series, Angel, starring David Boreanaz as a heroic vampire, and the two series currently run back-to-back on WB's Tuesday schedule. Let's listen to the first Buffy episode of this season, written by Joss Whedon. Buffy is having a difficult first year in college. She goes back to her old high school hangout and runs into her pal Xander, the only one of the old gang not going to college. Xander, played by Nicholas Brendon, asks her how it's going.
College is good.
Okay, once more with even less feeling.
No, really. I mean, Willow's in heaven, and Oz is this really cool house off campus with the band.
And you're sitting here alone at the Bronze, looking like you just got diagnosed with cancer of the puppy.
No, it's just... there was this vampire, and she took me down, and I don't know how to stop her.
Then where's the gang? Avengers assemble. Let's get it going.
No, I don't want to bug them. I mean, they're just starting school. I don't need this.
Okay, Buff. What's the what here?
It's just... what if I can't cut it?
Can't cut what? Slaying?
Slaying everything.
Joss Whedon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
We started this off by just listening to a very small piece from the first episode where Buffy is very reluctantly coming to terms with her fate. And I'm wondering if you can think back to that first episode so long ago and how you feel about where her character has grown and whether you anticipated any of that back in season one.
The character of Buffy has grown a lot. I had always imagined I would take her on a pretty long journey. I didn't realize exactly how far we'd go. I didn't realize how far the actress could go when we first started. I knew that I wanted somebody who had to deal with the responsibility of this great weight, this burden of being a slayer, and that would help her to grow up as a person. And but I didn't know, you know, until I worked with Sarah for a while, you know, how far she could take it, how deep she could go in terms of the grief she could experience and the growth and the intelligence she would bring to it.
Did you know what you wanted to do in terms of this TV series, having come from places like Roseanne and doing movies and stuff, what you wanted out of a TV experience?
Well, what I wanted was to create a fantasy that was emotionally completely realistic. That's what really interests me about anything. I love genre. I love horror. I love, you know, action. I love musicals. I love any kind of genre, and Buffy sort of embraces them all. But ultimately, the thing that interests me the most is people and what they're going through. And that's why I loved Roseanne. That's why I wanted to work on it, because it was the only sitcom I felt was genuinely funny and also very real and very kind of dark. And that's what I wanted to bring to this.
There's one thing I'm really curious about in terms of your work, and that's if you see it, what you're doing every week in Buffy is writing different chapters of a novel, that by being in control, because you spend so much time reflecting on past history of the characters and past things that they've done, if you're careful about the sequence and if I'm correct in presuming that you allow ramifications to spread on down the line with what these characters do from week to week?
Well, I'm very, very much aware of it as being like a novel. You know, the only equivalent to what you can do with a soap opera on TV to me is, you know, what Dickens was doing, and he happens to be my favorite novelist. The idea that you can get invested in a character for so long and see it go through so many permutations is fascinating to me. The shows that I've always loved the best, Hill Street Blues, Wise Guy, Twin Peaks, have always been shows that did have accumulative knowledge. One of the reasons why The X-Files started to leave me cold was that after 5 years, I just started yelling at Scully, "You're an idiot! It's a monster!" I couldn't take it anymore. I need people to grow. I need them to change. I need them to learn and explore and, you know, and die and do all of the things that people do in real life. And so we're very, very strict about making sure that things track, that they're presented in the right way. Because ultimately, and this is one of the things that I did find out after we had aired, the soap opera, the characters, the interaction between them is really what people respond to more than anything else. And although we came at it as a sort of monster of the week format, it was clear that the interaction was the thing that people were latching on to. So we were happy to sort of go with that and really play it up and really see where these characters were going to go. So now it is very much a continuing show, and we're always aware of that.
Now, what seasons of Roseanne did you work on, and what basically were the story arcs at the time?
I came in the second season. I was there for 1 year. It was, I guess Jackie was becoming a cop, and well, they were all very young. It was very early on. Roseanne had just quit her job and was unemployed for a while, and it was the beginning of her hunt for work. I quit after a year just because it was kind of chaos there.
Would you like to comment on the type of chaos?
The type of chaos was merely that, you know, they had a bunch of writers who really didn't know how to write the show or a show. They were sort of not the right people to be there. And then they had, you know, Roseanne was difficult. I don't think I'm breaking a big news story by explaining that.
Right.
And for a while, the chaos worked for me because I got to write a lot of scripts and I really got to work. I got in there. And then I sort of got shut out of the process by the producers as it got more insane there. They got more insular and they just sort of locked themselves in a room and I found myself with nothing to do. So I'd come in, work on Buffy, the movie script, and go home. And I realized that was not what I wanted to do, so I quit.
You were also pretty much a puppy then, weren't you? How old were you?
I was 24 when I started.
Yeah.
That qualifies me for puppy status,
I guess. Well, but, you know, one interesting thing about your doing television, even though you were working on film and stuff at the time, is that you're one of the few people that I've interviewed in terms of writer-producers where you don't imagine a scene where having to go home and tell your parents, oh, I'm going to write for television. Because, you know, it's in your line with both your father and your grandfather writing for TV.
Yes, it's true. Well, I do think there was a bit of, oh, maybe he'll do something better than we did. But no, my father was extraordinarily supportive.
Mm-hmm. Now, what in terms of your grandfather's credits, the only one that I know of is Donna Reed.
Donna Reed. There was Mayberry RFD, Dick Van Dyke. I know there was a Room 222 I saw in college that he wrote. But those were the ones that I remember the best. He also did radio before that. I have a bunch of great Gildersleeves that he wrote.
Oh, wow. And then your dad, besides Golden Girls?
Well, he did, when I was little, he did Captain Kangaroo and The Dick Cavett Show, and then he won an Emmy, actually, for being head writer of The Electric Company when he was still in New York. And then he came out here, he worked on Alice, Benson, Golden Girls, It's a Living.
Now, how did you get involved in film?
I always loved movies, always wanted to make movies. When I got to college, I ended up studying movies, to no one's great surprise, majoring in film, and not really having a clue about how it was I was going to enter the world of film, because I didn't really think about being a writer until necessity forced me to. And once I started writing spec TV scripts and realized that, you know, writing was my favorite thing in the world. But the idea was always to head towards the movie world, and eventually I wrote Buffy, which was not originally picked up, but did create a little heat, and I wrote a couple of specs, and I started to get movie work, and some of which was great, but most of which was ultimately pretty depressing.
Well, let's work through a little bit of that chronologically. I know in terms of your credited writing stuff, of course, there's Toy Story, everybody would know that, and probably Speed and Twister, Alien Resurrection.
Speed and Twister are not credited.
But they're the uncredited ones. I was going back and forth.
I can't believe you left out Waterworld, but because I'm so proud. apart from Waterworld and the X-Men, which is going to come out, and Titan AE, which is about to come out, there haven't been that many. I stopped doing it pretty much when Buffy came along. I had Alien about to start production, and so I had plenty, and so I haven't done a lot of rewrites lately.
Now, isn't the process completely different for writing a script for film when you can be one of, you know, 18 drones and a line gets in or nothing gets in versus being the writer-producer where it's your vision?
Yes, I mean, it's completely different. Everything about TV is geared towards the writer because ultimately it has to be a writer's medium. Yes, you have stars and some of them have enormous power, sometimes too much, sometimes the right amount, sometimes, you know, you get very smart people who know what they're doing, but ultimately, you know, you have to tell the story every week, and the bad news is if the story isn't that interesting, they're not coming back the week after. So you really have to maintain a level of quality that is based in story.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about how you get into position with the WB to turn a movie that at the time was 4 or 5 years old into a weekly series.
Well, Gail Berman went to work at Sandollar, and who had the rights to Buffy and very much wanted to turn it into a TV series. And when she approached me and I thought about, you know, the idea of telling horror stories about high school, since high school was pretty much one long horror story in my life, I thought that's actually a series that actually makes sense. That's interesting to me. So we developed it, and then the WB just right away, we pitched it to a couple of places. Fox turned us down. NBC, I don't even know why they asked us to come in. And then the WB got it right away, and my biggest fear was that they were going to say, make it stupider, make it lighter, make it fluffier. Take away the edge, and in fact, they very much encouraged the dark side of it.
My guest is Joss Whedon. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joss Whedon is my guest. He created the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Now, is it unfair to ask someone who creates all of these characters if there's one that you either relate to more or have more fun writing when you drop into the various skins?
You know, I have fun writing all. I love to write all of them. And part of that comes from the actors because their voices are so unique that the more I know them, the more. Like, I started to write Willow the way Allison spoke throughout the first season because she has such a particular cadence, and she and Nikki are both so witty. Of the characters that, you know, Spike is always going to be fun to write because he's always going to have the meanest opinion about anything. And therefore, you know, he's always got a good attitude. He's never just going to be there and be sincere and give exposition. He's always going to put a spin on something. As far as who I relate to, Xander was obviously, based on me, the sort of guy that all the girls want to be best friends with in high school. And who's, you know, kind of a loser, but is more or less articulate and someone you can trust. That part wasn't like me, but the rest was. And I also sometimes identify with Giles, particularly when I'm working, and I feel like I'm supposed to be the grown-up in this insane group of children who are not paying attention to me when we have this mission, which in my case is to create this show. And I also went to English boarding school, and so knew a lot of Giles-y people, so he has a particular resonance for me.
When you build this show, even though it was set in high school, when it came time for them to graduate, you allowed them to graduate and then moved on to a different venue in terms of college. Number one, is that a reaction against, you know, the AARP card-carrying members of Beverly Hills 90210 and that sort of thing? And is it just the idea of the ongoing Dickensian story that you want to tell?
Yeah, I wanted to do the next thing. And that sometimes I thought, oh, I wish I could have kept them in high school a little bit longer, but it would have started to look silly. I did make one compromise. I had Oz repeat a grade because I wanted him to be there for Willow, and he had ostensibly already graduated. So that was my one cheesy maneuver. But I really felt like, yes, I want to keep them in high school, and that's probably the way they feel. Yes, I'm worried that college is going to be, you know, different and not as cool, and we won't be as popular as a show, and that's what they'd feel. The important thing is always to match whatever your characters are going through to whatever you're going through as a creator to what the audience is going through. When people worried about how are you ever going to give Buffy a boyfriend after Angel, how are they ever going to get over each other? Well, that's exactly what Buffy was worried about. That's exactly what Angel was worried about. It's taking the challenges, it's taking the fears that you have, and letting everybody go through them, because ultimately everybody always does.
And then you also get the metaphors as well. When she goes to college and has a roommate from hell, it pretty much is a roommate from hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, there wasn't anybody I know who didn't say, oh, yeah, that was me. Yeah. Everybody thought that was based on them.
Whenever a program is not set in regular present-day normal stuff, I mean, everything from Star Trek to Bonanza, those shows are able, if they want to talk about certain issues at the time or to get away with some things that they can't otherwise. And I'm wondering if, well, the title of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the idea of monsters in some respects may make it a little harder for you to get respect from the Emmy community or something else, does it also make it easier for you to tell certain stories or explore certain ideas?
Absolutely, it makes it easier. You know, Star Trek dealt with a lot of issues, you know, that other people weren't dealing with. As I said before, Buffy's not really an issue show. It's more emotional, but it allows us to get into some very hairy emotional places week to week in a way that you just couldn't with a normal show. You'd think your characters were schizophrenic. When you have the fantasy, you know, element of, oh, here's my evil twin, you can really examine another side of a character, and you can go to a very dark place if you want to. You can kill people off, you can bring them back, you can do all these things, you can put everybody through intense emotional paces, and that emotional realism is the core to the show. It's the only thing I'm really interested in. But when you have just a normal show, you can't really take them that to that many different places without it just seeming very fake. It's like, you know, soap operas, it's like, who's going to get kidnapped today? You can only do that so many times. But when your show is structured around a genre show, horror or fantasy or science fiction, then you have, you know, great license. What we don't have, which is what some science fiction shows have, is we can't just do a thing because it seems cool. Everything that we pitch, everything that we put out there, whether or not it works, is based on the idea of the audience has been through this. A normal girl goes through this. A normal guy deals with this. You know, it's issues of sexuality, popularity, jobs, whatever it is. It's got to be based in realism. We can't just say, you know, the warships come and they, you know, they transmogrify the blah, blah, blah. We can't do that. We can go to some pretty strange places. But at the start, we always have to be about, what is the? How does the audience relate to having done this themselves? That's why when we aired Innocence, when Buffy slept with Angel and his curse went into effect and he became evil again, I went on the internet and a girl typed in, this is unbelievable, this exact thing happened to me. And that's when I knew that we were doing the show right.
All right, let's listen to a clip from Innocence. This is the episode where Angel becomes evil.
I was so worried.
I didn't mean to frighten you.
Where did you go?
Been around.
Oh, my God. I was freaking out. You just disappeared.
What? I took off.
But you didn't say anything. You just left.
Yeah. Like I really wanted to stick around after that.
What?
You got a lot to learn about men, kiddo. Although, I guess you proved that last night.
What are you saying?
Let's not make an issue out of it, okay? In fact, let's not talk about it at all. It happened.
I don't understand. Was it me? Was I not good?
You were great. Really, I thought you were a pro.
How can you say this to me?
Lighten up. It was a good time. Right? Doesn't mean like we have to make a big deal.
It is a big deal.
It's what? Bells ringing, fireworks, a dulcet choir of pretty little birdies? Come on, Buffy. Sound like I've never been there before.
Don't touch me.
Should have known you wouldn't be able to handle it.
Angel!
Love you, too. I'll call you.
That's David Boreanaz and Sarah Michelle Gellar in a scene from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. My guest, Joss Whedon, will be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Someone tell me why I do the things that I...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division. Publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Angel moves to Los Angeles and Willow finds a girlfriend. We continue our conversation with Buffy creator Joss Whedon. And Jeff Nunberg tells us what's wrong with so-called censorware.
There's a chair in my head in which I used to sit. Took a pencil and I wrote the following on it. Now there's a key. Throw it at me, dig it up, throw it at me. Where can I run to? Where can I hide?
turn to. Now I'm in a virgin state of mind. Got a knife to disengage the voids that I can't bear. To cut out words I've got written on my chair. Like, do you think I'm sexy? Do you think I really care?
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest is Joss Whedon, creator of the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Whedon has also written a number of the episodes, including the one we are about to hear. In a recent two-part episode, the character Faith, a Slayer who started using her power for evil instead of good, found a way to switch bodies with Buffy. So Sarah Michelle Gellar had to play Faith pretending to be Buffy. She's a bad Buffy, but her friends and enemies don't know that. And in this clip, bad Buffy is at a club and runs into Spike, played by James Marsters. Spike is a vampire adversary who no longer is able to bite people.
Oh, fine. Throw it in my face. Spike's not a threat anymore. I'll turn my back. You can't hurt me.
Spike. Spike. William the Bloody with a chip in his head. I kind of love this town.
You know why I really hate you, Summers?
Because I'm a stuck-up tight ass with no sense of fun?
Well, yeah, that covers a lot of it.
Because I could do anything I want. Instead, I choose to pout and whine and feel the burden of slayerness. I mean, I could be rich. I could be famous. I could have anything. Anyone. Even you, Spike. I could ride you at a gallop until your legs buckled and your eyes rolled up. I've got muscles you've never even dreamed of. I could squeeze you until you popped like warm champagne and you begged me to hurt you just a little bit more. And you know why I don't? Because it's wrong.
You wrote that, didn't you?
Yes, I did, actually.
Okay, so what's that like to write? What's it like to hand out to the different actors, and what's it like to have done on the floor?
Well, it's the most fun is writing it, is figuring out what these characters need to say to each other, and pushing the envelope sometimes in terms of the kind of content we get. Obviously, that could be taken to be a little bit dirty. That speech. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and Faith is very much somebody who uses her sexuality to, you know, wield power over people. It's, you know, once I give it to the actors, at this point, they're pretty much, they just go with it. You know, I can't surprise them anymore. They're used to having to do everything. The stranger things get, the more they have to play somebody who's not them, you know, the more they take it in stride. And shooting it is... You know, it just depends on the day. It's always fun to shoot scenes with James. Sarah loves working with him because, you know, he has a great rapport with everyone, and people don't get that many scenes with him, Spike, so they always relish them because he always brings a very different perspective. And for him to be completely controlled by somebody else in the scene, Faith, who is basically just badder than he is, you know, is a different experience for him. So that's always fun. But then you have to shoot like 19 angles of it, you know, and then it becomes less fun, and then it gets genuinely boring.
Right. I know that eventually it ends up as work, but it plays well on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the flexibility and the versatility, that's also definitely true of the co-stars and just about everybody who appears in the show. And I'm wondering, you came to Angel as the spinoff and to David Boreanaz's character, but you could have gone, it would seem, with a half dozen of them and spun off. How did you decide upon Angel?
Well, I have always been of the opinion that any one of these guys could sustain their own show. I think they're that good, I think they're that interesting, and I think they're that pretty. But Angel became the logical choice for a few reasons, and that was clear early on. One, he is, like Buffy, bigger than life. You know, he, for the first couple of seasons anyway, was the only superhero on the show in the sense that Buffy was. You know, he had something more. Now, you know, Oz became a werewolf, Willow became a witch, Everybody sort of had something to make them more than they'd been, but at the time, everyone else was a normal mortal, whereas Angel was kind of a bigger-than-life character, and if people responded to him like that, then he was going to have a kind of heat that would certainly make the network interested in making a show about him. I also knew that the romance between Buffy and Angel could go so far before it became incredibly tired, and we found interesting ways to shake that up. Obviously, the moment she slept with him, he turned evil, which, you know, as I was saying before, in that episode, Innocence, was a huge benchmark for the show. But ultimately, you know, there were only so many variations we could play. And so even though people are constantly yelling at me and screaming on the internet that I have to get them back together, we knew that there was going to come a time where there wouldn't be as much of a place for Angel on the show. So it made sense to give him his own.
The idea of getting to the point where you have him trying to redeem the bad character of Faith, because he had been a bad character himself, and then having Buffy come in and almost be the villain in this mm-hmm. triangle. Not the villain per se, but just that it changed the dynamics so much. These seem to be pretty high-stakes chess moves with these characters.
You can't bring Buffy to Angel without a good reason, without it making an impact. She can't just drop by and borrow a cup of sugar. For one thing, it's too difficult production-wise, and for another thing, it sort of lessens their impact as mythic characters. We brought her back once before, and they'd had the grand love that they'd always been denied in an episode called I Will Remember You, and then, of course, it was forced to take it all back, and she remembered none of it. So we had played, you know, great tragic romance in that respect, and it was a lot of fun and very much felt like a culmination of where they'd been going. But then what do you do the next time? And when we realized the kind of conflict they were going to have over Faith and how they would have two totally different perspectives about it, we realized that that was what we needed to play, that in terms of creating the mythic story with the big characters, here are three characters, you know, coming at an issue from three totally different angles, so they really conflict on a higher level. But at the same time, emotionally, it's that thing of you can't stay away from your old boyfriend or girlfriend, but you can't get along even remotely.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a clip from Angel. This is last week's show, where Buffy made a guest appearance.
I needed more time with Faith. Not sure.
You needed... any idea what it was like for me to see you with her? That you would behind my back...
Buffy, this wasn't about you. This was about saving somebody's soul. That's what I do here, and you're not a part of it. That was your idea, remember? We stay away from each other.
I came here because you were in danger.
I'm in danger every day. You came because of Faith. You were looking for vengeance.
I have a right to it.
Not in my city.
I have someone in my life now that I love. It's not what you and I had. It's very new. You know what makes it new? I trust him. I know him.
That's great. It's nice. You moved on. I can't. You found someone new. I'm not allowed to, remember? I see you again, it cuts me up inside. And the person I share that with is me. You don't know me anymore, so don't come down here with your great new life and expect me to do things your way. Go home.
That was a clip from Angel, and we're talking with its co-creator, Joss Whedon. One of the things that you do from time to time in Buffy and in Angel is to establish a very important character and then ruthlessly and unexpectedly kill them off. And you have said that you like surprises, but with Jenny, for example, in Buffy, and with Doyle, who was a co-star in Angel, you just set up these people and then take them from us. St. Elsewhere did that. Twin Peaks did that. Not a lot of TV shows do that. Why do you do that, and what reaction do you get from fans when you do it?
Well, I do it because because I want to keep people afraid. I want to keep people in suspense. I want people to understand that everything is not perfectly safe. The problem with doing a horror show on television is that you know your main characters are coming back week to week, and you don't really care about, you know, somebody who just showed up for one episode. So, you know, every now and then you have to make the statement, no, nothing is safe. And that's a very effective way of doing that. If somebody objects, if somebody says, how could you kill that character? You have to bring that character back. I know I've done the right thing. If they go, oh, they're dead, then I killed the wrong person because nobody cares. One of the things that people always shy away from is killing a sympathetic character. When I worked on Speed, there was a character who died, a lawyer that Alan Ruck played, and I took out the lawyer. He was a bad man. He was terrible. He was causing trouble, and he ended up dying. And I turned him into a likable sort of a doofy tourist guy. And they were like, well, now we can't kill him. And my opinion was, well, now you should, because now people will actually care when he dies.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody wants to kill a good guy. It makes them twitchy, particularly on a series. And we're very careful about it, because if there's somebody we know we're going to want for future episodes. But then again, Jenny Callender worked more episodes probably after she died than she did before, because on our show, everybody's a ghost, everybody's a whatnot. But it does inflame emotions sometimes, but that is, in fact, what I'm trying to do.
My guest is Joss Whedon, creator and executive producer of the show. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joss Whedon. When you talk about the resonance of characters and keeping the history going, back in the episode of Doppelganger, I guess a couple of seasons ago now, there was a reference made to Willow, Allison Hannigan's character, as, at least in this other existence, having a bisexual sexuality, and that supposedly, based on the doppelganger rules, that might mean something on this real Buffy world. And in the most recent episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I think was, by the way, a very dramatic and very well-done hour of television, it culminated with a readjustment of Willow's sexuality. And yet, if you've been watching the show for a couple of years, it wasn't like an Ellen move or anything else that was pulled out. It seemed very organic and natural to the story. And I was wondering how the decision was reached to go that way and with as much restraint as the episode presented it.
Well, the arc between Willow and Tara has kind of a long and sort of tortured history. We had thought about the idea of someone exploring their sexuality, expanding a little bit in college, because that's felt like one of the things that might happen in college. Since we tend to work inside metaphor for most of the show, you know, we talked about Willow and her, you know, being a witch, because it's a very strong female community. And it gives her a very physical relationship with someone that isn't necessarily sexual at first. And then when we decided to go that way, part of it was because Seth Green wanted to step out and do movies, and we knew that he was going to be out of the picture, and, you know, we had to do something with Willow, and it seemed like a good time for her to be exploring this. Then the question just became, how much do we play in metaphor, and how much do we play as, you know, her actually expanding her sexuality? And you're walking a very fine line there. The network obviously has issues. They don't want any kissing. That's one thing that they've stipulated, and they're a little nervous about it. Ultimately, they haven't interfered at all with what we've tried to do, but they have, you know, they've raised a caution about it. You know, at the same time, you have people, the moment Tara appeared on the scene, saying, well, they're obviously gay. Why aren't they gay enough? They're not gay enough. You need to make them more gay. You know, people want you to make a statement. They want you to turn it into an issue right away. So you sort of have forces buffeting you, and you're trying to come up with what is both emotionally sort of correct as a progression and also sort of mythically significant in terms of your greater arc. You're trying to wield all these things and week to week sort of make this thing progress.
Now, when you do these major moves for your characters, the story meetings that you have with the other writer producers, how far ahead are you working? What's your Bible like, or whatever it's called?
Generally speaking, I come into a season with the arc for the season, the main villain, the main sort of journeys for each of the characters. Where are they going to go? Some benchmarks, certain episodes, somewhere around episode 10, this has to happen. Somewhere around episode 15, this has to happen. We have to keep it flexible because you come up with better ideas, or an actor falls out, or something happens. You know, the process of creating TV is entirely fluid. You always have to be ready to be thrown a curve. And in our case, every time we have, I think it's helped us out a great deal. I really think what we're doing with Willow and Tara is interesting, and Amber Benson's a wonderful actress. That might not have happened if we hadn't lost Seth. You always have to be ready for those things, and they tend to work out really well if you are. But at the same time, you must have a bigger plan, both emotionally and structurally, because I make each show, each year on Buffy, work as a separate arc. I did that with the first season because I didn't know if we were ever going to air again, and I absolutely hate a show that ends in the middle before everything's over. It drives me insane if the story isn't finished. So with Prophecy Girl, the last episode of the first season, I finished the story, and if we had never aired another show, it would have still been a self-contained unit of 12 episodes that told a story. So that's how we designed every year. And right now we're in the process of discussing year 5 of Buffy and year 2 of Angel, figuring out, you know, the benchmarks for those episodes, for those seasons.
And I guess my last question then is there anything in general you can tell us about any of those story arcs in general? Or, if not, what you can tell us about what you're doing next?
Well, I can't tell you much about what's going to happen next year because I don't like to spoil things. I'm a great believer in the surprise, and although it's incredibly difficult actually to have a surprise, especially with the internet, I do like to try every now and then to shock people. It's going to be a very different year on Buffy than it was, certainly. This last year was about college. It was about the sudden freedom and how you try on new personas and how your gang kind of falls apart, and you sort of, you know, at the end of your first year of college, you're in a very different place. Next year is really about family, is about getting the group back together and really working within the group. It's about sort of refocusing. And so I think people who feel like the Scooby Gang, the Buffy's friends and whatnot, have become a little peripheral, they're going to be pleased. We're going to see much more intense interaction between all our main characters, who all sort of got scattered in this last year. And what I'm going to be doing next is figuring out what all that literally means, because right now we're just we're starting to break stories for both shows, and just I don't really have time for a whole lot else.
Well, you made me feel guilty about taking up this much of your time, but thank you very much for being here.
No,
it's a pleasure to have you
here. Appreciate it. Thank you. It was good to talk to you.
Joss Whedon is the creator and executive producer of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the co-creator of its spin-off series Angel. Both shows air new episodes tonight on the WB. Here's a scene from tonight's new episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. In this scene, the Scooby Gang are all fighting and seem to be ready to go their separate ways.
You guys, stop this! What happened to you today?
It's not today. Buffy, things have been wrong for a while. Don't you see that?
Well, what do you mean wrong?
Well, they certainly haven't been right since Tara. We have to face it. You can't handle Tara being my girlfriend.
No! It was bad before that, since you tuned off to college and forgot about me. Just left me in the basement to...
Tara's your girlfriend?
Bloody hell.
Enough! All I know is you want to help, right? Be part of the team?
I don't
really
know
not
anymore.
No! No, you said you wanted to go. So let's go. All of us. We'll walk into that cave with you two attacking me and the funny drunk drooling on my shoe. Hey! Hey, maybe that's the secret way to killing Adam.
Buffy.
Is that it? Is that how you can help? You're not answering me. How can you possibly help? So, I guess I'm on my own. And you know what? I'm starting to understand why there's no ancient prophecy about a chosen one and her friends.
A scene from tonight's episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Coming up, trying to screen out porn on the web, a commentary from our linguist, Jeff Nunberg. This is Fresh Air. Adult-oriented material on the web has been a source of concern for many parents. Over the past few years, software companies have been offering programs that promise to screen out pornography and other kinds of offensive material. But as our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out, it's not quite that simple.
Schools and libraries under pressure to block young people's access to pornographic or racist sites, businesses concerned about employees surfing, parents worried about what their children might run into on the web, they've all been installing the content filtering programs that go by names like Cyber Sitter, Cyber Patrol, Net Nanny, and Surf Watch, what some people refer to as censorware. It's already a $100 million industry, and it'll grow even faster if Congress adopts any of the various bills that require the installation of the software in all schools and libraries that are receiving certain federal subsidies. The only problem is that the programs don't deliver. They all work in more or less the same way. They start by hand-compiling a list of sites that contain pornography or other offensive content, then add additional filters to block sites that contain certain keywords and phrases. But most of the programs turn out to have been deliberately blocking a lot of sites that have nothing to do with pornography or violence. Feminist and gay discussion groups, safe sex information, the homepage of the National Organization for Women, probably because it has links to gay and lesbian sites. In short, they try to rule out anything that any customer might find objectionable. What's more, those filters that are supposed to automatically spot objectionable content turn out to be wildly inaccurate. Not long ago, one anti-censorship group published a list of the first 50 URLs in the EDU domain that were blocked by the censorware program iGear. It turned out that fully 76% of these pages were errors or misclassifications. The block pages included a diagram of a milk pasteurization system, a couple of sections of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and some Latin passages from St. Augustine's Confessions. When I looked at those, they turned out to come from the section where Augustine complains that he still has impure thoughts, but I have the feeling that wasn't why the program blocked them. Probably it had more to do with the fact that the passages contained the Latin preposition cum, as in cum laude. And other systems have blocked sites as innocuous as the home pages of the British Conservative Party and Beaver College in Pennsylvania, not to mention the text of that well-known pornographic classic, Jane Eyre. Some people might say that this is just the price we have to pay for blocking the truly offensive sites, but it turns out that the systems aren't foolproof there either. The software makers like to claim that they can block anywhere from 90 to 97% of the objectionable content on the web, whatever they mean by that. But even if the systems could block 99% of the explicitly pornographic sites, you might have qualms about leaving a child alone with them. At a best estimate, there are more than 100,000 porn sites on the web, and even the most efficient filtering system would leave thousands of them available. And bear in mind that a single porn site isn't like a handgun or a gram of cocaine. Just one can serve an indefinitely large number of users. In the end, the effect would be like reducing the number of available TV channels from 100 to 3. You might limit the variety of the content, but you wouldn't necessarily reduce the size of the audience. When it comes to the crunch, putting a content filtering system in a library is like putting a metal detector at the airport that lets through 5% of the guns and beeps at half the wooden hangers that people have in their suitcases. None of this should be surprising. Sensorware programs are like every other kind of software that tries to deal with human language in a natural way. Systems for automatic translation, for example, or search engines that promise to understand ordinary English questions. These systems have their uses, but they can never approach our own language capacities simply because human language is too complicated to be reduced to the kind of rules that a computer can deal with, at least at the present stage of the technology. And if computers have trouble rendering a simple sentence from English to French or understanding a simple question like, "Where is Joey Buttafuoco from?" why would anybody suppose that we can count on them to recognize the much more subtle distinctions between pornography and useful information? How have the makers of sensorware programs been able to gull the public about the capacities of the systems? In part, it's because the software houses don't ever make public the lists of sites that the programs block, so that their customers are kept in the dark about just how badly they perform. But mostly, it's just a kind of wishful thinking that's endemic with new technologies. We want to believe that we can rely on the technology itself to provide magic bullets for all the social problems it gives rise to. And of course, the software provides an easy out for administrators and politicians who want to be able to say that they're doing something about the problem. The makers of the software insist that they're not in the business of censorship. After all, they're private firms, not government organizations. But when schools and public libraries are required to install the programs, it's hard to think what other term you would use. Still, there is a difference between the new censorship and the old. We're no longer at the mercy of repressive autocrats who decide what we can read. Now we leave the decision to dim-witted software code. That's a change, but I don't know if I'd call it progress.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui-Westman with Patty Leswick. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Guru.com, staffing short-term projects in a variety of fields, including creative, technology, marketing, and strategy. Guru.com. From Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division. Hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope, by Jonathan Kozol. And from Random House, Incorporated, Bantam Books Division. Publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, the new novel by Tom Robbins. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Western imagination turned Tibet into Shangri-La, and why the Dalai Lama is on Hollywood's A-list. We talk with journalist Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet. And we meet Vatan Saroy, publisher of the leading independent Albanian newspaper in Kosovo. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.